This is Audible.
Audible Frontiers presents Metatropolis, a shared universe project. Written by Jay Lake, Tobias Bakel, Elizabeth Baer, John Scalzi, and Carl Schrader. Read by Michael Hogan, Scott Brick, Candace McClure, Alessandro Giuliani, and Stefan Rednicki.
Hello, and welcome to Metatropolis. I'm your tour guide, John Scalzi. And the reason I'm your tour guide is that I'm the editor of this anthology, as well as the writer of one of the novellas you'll be listening to. What I didn't want to do was the usual anthology idea, in which writers are given a theme and then set off to work in isolation. What I thought would be more interesting would be to collect a set of smart, engaged authors and then have them build a world together, and having established this world, then go off and write their stories. We would get the advantages of a communally created setting, everyone in the same world, and all the advantages of individual writers creating stories in their own style. Carl Schrader got the ball rolling by proposing the idea of future cities, not just the standard-issue Jetsons future cities, or another take on the city-states of medieval times gussied up with technology, but the idea that the cities would be something like an interstitial nation, that the people of a future Detroit or Portland might have more in common with the people in Hong Kong or Johannesburg than they might with the people right down the road. The title of this anthology is Metatropolis, which means, more or less, the city beyond. The cities you'll be hearing about here are meant to be just that, a step beyond what you know or what you may have expected. This could be your future. I hope you're ready for it. Now on to the first story. One of the most cliched pieces of writing advice out there is write what you know. But the reason this advice is cliché is that it just happens to be true. In the case of Jay Lake, this included locale. Jay is a proud citizen of Cascadia, that metropolitan corridor that stretches from Portland up to Vancouver, British Columbia, and it's here that he sets his story. Now, writing what you know is all well and good, but this is also speculative fiction. So Jay's Cascadia is different from the Pacific Northwest you know, or that you think you know. Jay's touch with world-building is impressive enough that it made sense for us to put his story first and let it be the one that gives you a sense of the world that we created together. So here's Jay Lake, Cascadia, and In the Forests of the Night, read by Michael Hogan.
Introit. It would be nice to say that Tiger arrived in Cascadiopolis on the wings of a storm, riding the boiling front of electric darkness and lashing rain like a tall, handsome man out of some John Ford Western, or that he came through shadow and fire by a secret tunnel through the honeycombed basalt bones of these green-covered mountains, a hero out of templed legend following the journey of the gods. It would be nice, but inaccurate. Tiger arrived the way almost everyone comes to Cascadiopolis, either by accident, by judicial design, or by following the damp silences between the trees higher and higher until there was nowhere left to go. In Tiger's case, all three. His name was Tiger Tiger, spelled the way Blake originally did, T-Y-G-R-E. Or, if you prefer to file it by last name as so many sentencing authorities and similar busybodies do, Tiger, comma, Tiger. Not that he had a file, which made him unusual for someone who wasn't otherwise born and raised completely off the grid. But then Tiger was unusual from before we ever saw him to long after we laid him down in the forest loam, beneath a simple stone marked only with a stylized flame. Death improves everyone's reputation. For some, it also multiplies their power. Bashar grunts. A familiar weary look nestles in his narrowed eyes, visible to the pickets even in the deep, green-black shadows of a Cascades evening. The men and women who stand at Cascadiopolis's first line of defense know better than to give him cause for challenge. Not when he is in this mood. Even the new fish like Camilla understand this, with the same brute instinct that keeps young cats alive in the face of a battle-scarred neighborhood Tom. Still, she is not so smart as she should be. Spiked into camo netting 40 feet up a Douglas fir, she tries to sneak a hand-rolled smoke. Cigarettes are so 20th century, the pocket-sized equivalent of an SUV these days. But there's been a fad for them in the cities up and down the I-5 corridor. Every generation ignores the lessons of the one before. It's not tobacco. Long-haul transport is too difficult and expensive for something that doesn't pay good euros by the gram. But a mix of locally grown herbs and good old-fashioned ganja. Rolling papers can be sourced regionally from the old Crown Z mill up on the Washington side of the Columbia. Everyone knows this. The old hands, meaning anyone who has been on the picket line for more than a week, also know that Bashar hates cigarettes with the same passion that he hates concrete, white people, and internal combustion. Camilla does not know this. So she clicks her sparker and takes a drag inside a cupped hand. Bashar has the hearing of a bat. They whisper to one another when the commander is on the far side of a basalt-ribbed ridgeline. He stops. Pressure rifle suddenly cocked and without turning his head says, "Miller." She accidentally swallows the butt, then chokes hard on the mix of hot tip, raw smoke, and an inch of lumpy paper going down her throat. "Sir?" she squeaks. "Drop it." The new recruit almost says, "Drop what?" A relic of oppositionally defiant teenhood so recently left behind. But the absolute silence from her fellow pickets warns her. Cautiously, she casts her sparker down. It hits the mossy ground with a muffled thud to be swallowed by the shadows at the base of her tree. "The fag, Miller," Bashar now sounds bored. That is when he is at his most dangerous. "Drop the fag." "I don't have it," she whispers, then belches smoke and paper shards amid a searing pain in her larynx. Still not looking over his shoulder, Bashar snaps off a 3-needle burst from his weapon, which takes Camilla in the meat of her thigh. She squeaks with the agony of the non-lethal hit as the tangy reek of blood blooms among the trees. Whatever he was going to do to her next was lost amid a startled challenge from Ward. 100 yards downslope, hunkered down behind a lichen-riddled boulder. Her voice crackles over the dissociated network of Turked combuds, shouting, "Halt!" A fraction of a second later, the words echo through the cooling air. Bashar moves like a mountain lion on a wounded sheep, fast, hard, and silent, as he makes the long descent in a dozen bounds. Ward knows better than to apologize. She is no new fish, but she has the stranger in her sights. He is Tiger, of course, though none of us have heard of him yet, and he has walked right past the outer line of Bashar's pickets as if they were a row of dead streetlights on some Portland boulevard. The picket commander meets the invader face to face in a rare pool of moonlight this deep beneath the spreading arms of the montane forest. For a moment, even this toughest of the renegade city's partisans is lost in the mystery of the man who would be their king. We quote from the introduction to a master's thesis written during the last year that the Sorbonne was still a degree-granting institution. The early decades of the 21st century brought the collapse of the American project. A noble experiment in democracy and economics had transitioned through imperialism, then dove straight into the same hollow irrelevancy which had seized the 18th century Spanish crown, a zombie empire shambling onward through the sheer weight of its extents, but devoid of initiative or credibility. Where Spain had been dogged by England in those post-Armada years, America after Reagan was hunted by a pack of baying hounds, transnational terrorists, post-NATO powers, and resource-funded microstates with long-armed grudges. All this while rotting from the inside, as the true failures of internal combustion-centered urbanism were finally exposed like worms in the heart of a prize bitch. Hope was not dead, but it lived in strange, isolated colonies on the warm corpse of the United States. Astronomers listened to good news from outer space in their enclaves in Arizona, Wyoming, and West Texas. Green entrepreneurs only a generation removed from South Asia and Eastern Europe, clustered amid the Monterey Pines of Big Sur, in the cornfields of Iowa, within sealed half-buried arcologies along Pamlico Sound. The stochastic city blossoming, hidden amid the near ruins of Detroit, silent and extra-official as it was, prospered as no city had since the 1947 founding of a Levittown, unknowingly sentenced urban cores to slow death. Cascadiopolis was an equally stealthy Western answer to Detroit's secret of rebirth. Built on federal land, its inception funded by a handful of private philanthropists, its initial design ruthlessly controlled by a Colorado environment activist who fancied himself a latter-day Pablo Lugari, blessed with a much larger canvas. The city that was not a city, hidden high in the Cascades, grew not despite itself, but through the sort of deliberate intent not seen in North America since Pierre L'Enfant laid out the streets of the District of Columbia. Where Washington's diagonal avenues had been arranged to provide maximum opportunity for enfilading cannon fire to repel British invaders, Cascadiopolis defends itself in far more subtle and effective ways. Tiger Tiger aimed to approach that city much as the British had approached James Madison's Washington. Like his historical predecessors, he would set flame to the seat of power. Like them, he would ultimately fail, while the dream that was the heart of the city would endure. Tiger was a tall man, like all natural leaders. We are not so far from the fruit trees of Central Africa, and the same height which confers the advantages of long-armed reach and the first glimpses of danger also helps dominate committee meetings and win bar fights. Our genes know this, far deeper even than our socialization, which only reinforces the message. The newcomer is ambiguously colored in the pooling moonlight of the Cascades night. Bashar cannot decide for a moment exactly which species of hatred he will deploy on this intruder, so arrogant as to walk straight through his brutally trained pickets. The newcomer doesn't seem to be a white man, but neither is he safely, anonymously dark-skinned. Something weird, like an Andaman Islander, or someone from the genetic melting pots of late unlamented West Coast liberalism. Distrust is universal, Bashar reminds himself as he slips the muzzle of his weapon up into the soft skin at the bottom of the taller man's chin. Welcome to the end of the line, he whispers. Tiger is unperturbed, calm as a man being handed a check by a bank president. When he speaks, his voice has a timbre that could call armies to the march, bring men and women alike to their knees, or fill an offering plate. I rather prefer to believe this is a beginning. Bashar nearly shoots the man right there and then, but something stays his hand. He would be within the rules of engagement. Nobody legally enters Cascadiopolis by night, not ever. You never heard of the Granite Gate? That is the outpost much further down in the watershed, where the abandoned railroad spur runs out of trestle, where people with visas or deportation orders or any of 100 essential materials cited on the ever-circulating lists can appear and apply for entry. Even here, in the heart of fog-bound anarchy, there are processes, rules, requirements to be followed. Freedom must be protected by a wall of suspicion. Only rats slip through under the dark of night. They are trapped, beaten, skinned, then hung out to rot on iron poles at the farthest boundaries of the city's territory, like shrike-impaled prey. These measures are largely effective, making the work of Bashar's pickets much easier. but not tonight. It was not convenient for me, says Tiger. Convenient, says Bashar, as if he has never encountered the word before. Despite himself, he is fascinated. No one has been so utterly unafraid of him since he hit puberty. 30 years and a near collapse of civilization later, Bashar's very name is a byword for brutally effective security from Eureka to Prince Rupert. No, Tiger smiles. In that moment, the true force of him is revealed like diamonds being spilled from a velvet bag. Calling it charm would be like calling a North Pacific typhoon a breeze. A tall, handsome man with a voice like bottled thunder can take on armies. A tall, handsome man with a voice of bottled thunder and that smile can take over nations. Even Bashar is set back. We have rules, he says weakly, a last gasp of bluff in the face of defeat. 1,000,000 years of evolution have conflated with the raw tsunami of one man's power to overcome even his profound distrust. His pressure rifle drops away from Tiger's chin. What's your name? Bashar barely swallows the sir hanging at the end of that sentence. Tiger. The word rolls through all the pickets on the Turked comm circuit, echoes in the ears of those within shouting distance even though the man is whispering, launches into the air like the compressed chirp of an uplink releasing orbital kinetics on some unsuspecting ground site. Some last vestige of procedure rescues Bashar from terminal embarrassment. You have a visa, Tiger. Do I need one? His voice holds the infinite patience of a kindly god. Asylum? Mutters someone sotto voce in the dark. Bashar doesn't even seem to notice for a long, hanging moment. Then he echoes the word as if the thought were his own. Asylum. You can claim it. I claim asylum. The gentle humor in Tiger's voice would make a stone smile. Part of a memorandum from the Security Subcommittee to the Citizens Executive. Originally drafted shortly after Tiger arrived in Cascadiopolis. A cursory analysis of the action reports from the first penetration will show that virtually every picket on the south slopes claimed to have seen Tiger personally on his entrance to our territory. This is clearly impossible, as the deployment patterns were not significantly disrupted that night, as evidenced by comm time position tags. As might be expected, the descriptions provided in those action reports vary widely. At least 3 pickets, specifically Alpha 7, Alpha 10, and Gamma 3, claim that Tiger's skin showed stripes in the moonlight. Given that first contact was made by Alpha 5, and Bashar's intervention occurred within Alpha 5's free fire zone, it is impossible for any Gamma picket to have witnessed the encounter, and strongly doubtful that Alpha 10 saw more than silhouettes. Yet, the action reports possess the intense conviction of passionate eyewitness testimony. Clearly, the pickets all believe they saw a Tiger. Citizen Cole has advanced a theory of mass hallucination brought on by biological, chemical, or pharmacological agents. However, she offers no possible dispersal mechanism. Citizen Lane has suggested multiple persons in stealth suits or other low-visibility gear, combined with the power of suggestion. It is the opinion of this office that while judgment should be withheld in the details of this matter, there was no significant breach of security other than what was documented by Bashar in his own report. While we are hesitant to simply dismiss the testimony of so many pickets as fantasy, there is no more reliable explanation available. In the meantime, Tiger will continue to be monitored closely, just as he has been since entering the city. Cascadiopolis welcomes Tiger with dank, mossy arms indistinguishable from any bouldered stand of trees by night. He enters the city silent as mist off the river. Bashar walks before him, point man on a patrol the security chief had never thought to walk. Prisoners not summarily executed are bound over to the evaluation subcommittee. That body is made up of specialists, much like Bashar himself, though their focus is on information extraction rather than perimeter security. It is the self-conscious paradox of distributed self-governing communities that such experts emerge in the face of demand. Hydrologists, medics, and economic theorists, for example. And it was not yet understood where the bounds of loyalty lie. The city is among the trees of the trees in a way that even the great-souled visitor has not yet understood. This is the city that is not a city. Close kin to the urban pioneers of Detroit, but springing from a different resource base. Where the stochastic farms were atop abandoned shopping malls and office blocks, their living spaces distributed and ephemeral within the centuries of civic infrastructure towering above the rattled Michigan earth, Cascadiopolis is built from the basalt bones of the Oregon Cascades. 17 million years ago, in response to a crust-busting cometary impact, the region drowned in a mantle plume of molten rock that eventually grew to be a mile deep. Basalt fractures as it cools, forming hexagon pillars of seemingly unnatural regularity. The later return of the stratovolcanoes lifted the recognizable peaks of the modern Cascades, Hood, Adams, St. Helens, pulling the midsection of the Columbia River basalt flow upward with the rising line of the mountains. The hidden pillars of the earth cracked as they emerged. The emerging shoulders of the young mountains birthed hidden lava tubes. In time, all was covered with the rumpled green blanket of lichen, moss, ferns, rhododendrons, and eventually the towering Douglas firs, western hemlock, and lodgepole pines. The old-growth forest tops 300 feet in height. Trees of a size unimaginable to city-raised eyes from deep in the east. Bury your city that is not a city in long lava tubes the size of subway tunnels. Build it among the natural pillars framing the cliff faces and ravines. Stake it to the flanks of forest giants 20 feet in diameter. Spread your trails under vast networks of rhododendrons. Draw your water from glacier melt streams and seep springs. Do all that. Build no fires. And you will be invisible to satellite and aerial surveillance. Even thermal imaging gets lost in the deep shadows of those spreading canopies. Populate your city with biotech engineers, refugee coders, third-generation hippie grass farmers, anyone with skill and will. Place them amid your shadowed outdoor halls with luciferase cold lights engineered from the firefly genome, and you have an intelligent pale constellation beneath the cold roof of night. Tiger enters this mystical night of chilly shadows and watchful eyes. Bashar stalks before him, a squat and vengeful god already rethinking the virtues of human sacrifice. Tiger knows, but does not care. His supreme indifference to the jealousies and violences of the world is among the chiefest of his charms. The people of Cascadiopolis emerge from their camo netting. Children crawl from beneath thermal blankets tucked inside dripping bushes. A manufacturing team puts down their water-powered lathes and spring-loaded microchip pullers to stare. Fungus farmers abseil down from the high branches, leaving their reeking troughs unattended. Currency reverse arbitrators abandon their palm-sized terminals to leave 500,000 new yuan stranded in a Flemish forex repository. Shovels in hand, the labor subcommittee emerges from the trench of a brown water pipe project to stare. Tiger has come to Cascadiopolis, and the city has risen to meet him. He follows Bashar into the lava tube known as Symmetry, along with the tubes named Objectivity and Innovation. Symmetry serves as secure storage for anything requiring metal concentrations or chemical shielding, as well as the chambers for the governance necessary to any functioning anarchy. Symmetry is where the Security Subcommittee maintains its weapons caches and its interrogation rooms. Those elements of their work not subject to the decentralization ethos by which Cascadiopolis governs itself. Government is very much on Tiger's mind, of course, because he has a purpose in all things he does, most of all in stealing a march behind the wall of the most reclusive city in America, being his own Trojan horse, in effect. He steps carefully along the resin-soaked fir logs leading down into the mossy darkness of cemetery. There he will face the first passage of this, his final and greatest performance. The great man whistles as he passes within, a song out of religious history which gives pause to the watching multitudes behind him, their eyes shining with the pallid echoes of destiny walking. Gradual. Happiness Cardoza stalks the granite gate. She has spent most of a week in a tiny high-altitude survival shelter buried in leaves and mud, almost a half a mile east of the site. Greeny patrols have passed within a dozen feet of her at least twice since then, but she continues invisible. Though she can be dangerous in the way of hard, competent women and men of her generation, her only weapon on this hunt is a fluid lens scope. It is a South African import, turked from the far side of the world to bring her a small miracle of static electricity and focused monopole magnetics. Not being a fool, she has much more lethal hardware cached nearby, just in case. She doesn't pretend to understand the physics of the scope, but she certainly understands the operation. Cardoza can count the pimples on the chin of the young greeny currently frontlining Cascadiopolis's doorway. She can even dial in a fisheye view of each individual ruddy excrescence. "Quit scratching yourself, Otis," she thinks toward the kid. "You'll have a happier life later on." No bullet for the guard this mission. His lucky day. Instead, she is watching process, to see how often the greenies vary their routines. Cardoza is looking for patterns amid the variations. She knows those patterns are there. No human being is capable of truly random behavior. Not even the legendary Bashar. There are only so many viable patrol routes, for example. They have to follow different paths to avoid leaving a trackway in the forest. At the same time, the terrain itself dictates where those patrols must travel to be effective. Likewise, the guards at the granite gate. This one, whom she has nicknamed Otis, has been on several different shifts. He and his peers switch shifts around for a few days, then rotate back to whatever other labor the collective as hell of Cascadiopolis has assigned to them. Their only regular behavior is the manner in which would-be immigrants and traders are processed. A necessity, of course, for such dealings as the greenies have with the wider world. That consistency is the defender's weakest point. But it isn't Cardoza's ideal approach. Bashar is the polar opposite of a fool, and expects just such a line of attack. Cardoza is certain that if she approached with papers or trade goods, she'd be found out. Perimeter probes had proven disastrous. If her employers were lucky, they might identify the body from the skinned corpses hanging in the forest glades. More often, the operatives just vanished dead or swallowed up by the greenies. Cardoza's plan is to watch at least a week. She has been creating a baseline of the behaviors at the granite gate, identifying all the interdiction activities in play along with whatever she can observe of their patterns and meta-patterns of deployment. She also carefully watches who is admitted and who is turned away, in case some detail in that process suggests an approach despite her intuition. She is empowered to make a reconnaissance into Cascadiopolis, opportunity permitting, but no one expects her to do so. Least of all, Cardoza herself. She doesn't do suicide missions, not even against green freaks. Eventually, she'll withdraw and make her way back down into the foothills to where her bike is hidden. No two-wheelers on these rough slopes. Down below, a long night's ride to Portland's West Hills will bring her back to her employers. Mostly she scans, makes notes, and thinks. Oregon's Willamette Valley had been spared much of the worst of what has overtaken the ruins of America. An area once blessed with an overabundance of rainfall retreated into mere shortages, as opposed to the wholesale drought which depopulated the Southwest from central Texas to southern California. Likewise, the summer heat was merely unbearable, while the winter hurricanes, which first began in the century's first decade, lashed the Northwest without drowning it Gulf of Mexico style. Still, Portland these days was more like historic Cairo, with its cycle of flood and drought depositing permanent layers of mud in the downtown streets and rendering the old industrial district of the near southeast virtually worthless. Most of the money had long since retreated to Dubai, Johannesburg, and other centers of 21st century wealth. What remained in Portland had climbed the West Hills, bought out the zoning rules, and created a series of glittering arcologies for itself. These Assyrian constructions were anchored against the already bizarre fixture of the OHSU hospital complex, atop Marquam Hill, folding reliable access to antibiotics, nuclear medicine, and worthwhile trauma care into the blanket of such wealth and privilege as remained to dominate the Oregon landscape. William Silas Crown sat in the sky-spanning penthouse of the Council Crest Arcology and stared east toward where Mount Hood would be if the air were clear enough to see it anymore. Crown could recall easily enough his youth when the mountain was a snowbound chevron floating in the silver skies. He still knew where to find it, even if no one under 30 could point to the peak with any confidence. "Streeter," he said to the empty air, "has there been any update on Project Verdancy?" "No, sir," replied his executive assistant, stepping in from the office next door. She was a willowy woman of mixed Asian extraction, with that strange hyper-efficiency that sufficient money could buy, or at least put on the payroll. "Meaning reports without status changes, or meaning no reports at all?" Streeter didn't even glance at her wrist. "Asset Kai has been bouncing a chirp off the Galileo 2 Eurosats on schedule. Keep alive only, no updates. She is in place and observing as planned. Asset Tau penetrated the target last night. No status check since, which is within operational parameters." Crown tapped his teeth with his index finger. "And our sources inside?" "Current status unknown, sir. There has been no evidence of recent compromise." "Of course there hasn't." Bashar was too good for that sort of thing. Crown would never know until he realized he didn't know anything at all. Still, such a mare's nest of rogue talent and soft path tech simply couldn't be ignored. He was long past believing in the sanctity of much of anything, but some things just shouldn't be kept hidden. Not that Cascadiopolis itself mattered a whit. The green freaks could go camping in the woods until the entire range burned out for all he cared. He didn't have timber rights, possessed no interest in access control. Crown was far more interested in the innovation arising from that misguided band of anarchists. Once the geek American community had wrenched itself away from the 40-year sideshow that had been the software industry and gone back to good old-fashioned hardware, not to mention good new-fashioned biotech, the game had changed. Barely in time, either. The case study was around gas in a jar. Several California startups had engineered petroleum-producing microbes in the late 2000s. The oil shocks arising from the American failures in the Middle East produced the necessary economic boost to kickstart development, but lacking a Terminator gene, the bugs had gone home in the pockets of too many lab assistants tired of $6 per gallon gas. Within another decade, anyone with a high school science education and the talent to brew beer was in the oil production business. And nobody had made any damn money off the greatest revolution in energy production since Colonel Edwin Drake started digging holes in Pennsylvania farmland back before the Civil War. If these idiots weren't smart enough to capitalize on their own intellectual property, he would damn well do it for them. The world needed those quiet innovations, at least if anyone planned to keep the lights on much longer. Beachfront condos in the Beaufort Sea were fine for sun worshippers with enough money, like Crown himself. There were a few billion people starving in place. The green freaks weren't going to keep it all to themselves. Their intellectual property was too damn valuable to be pissed away on hippie dreams. Better someone who could do some good got hold of it. Crown realized Streeter had been speaking. "I'm sorry, Evelyn," Crown admitted. "I lost track for a moment."
"Carbon, sir."
"Carbon?" "They've been sourcing carbon nanotubes in laboratory quantities."
"Not industrial quantities?" he asked.
"No, sir. Not unless they're running a very small industry."
He turned that over in his head. Why would the green freaks need nominal quantities of carbon nanotubes?
Because they'd found a way of making their own up there in the woods. Charcoal ovens are similar crap, tended by some hyper-focused hippie with a set of nano-manipulators. Reference testing, Streeter, they've figured out something important, I suspect. May I congratulate you on the fortuitous timing of Project Verdancy? Crown laughed bitterly. In the past 5 years, we've traced 11 significant innovations in manufacturing, data management, distributed systems, and closed-loop resource management back to Cascadiopolis. And that's only what we can account for. All of them released open source, so widespread before they were detected that any IP action would be profoundly meaningless, even with an airtight license in place after the fact. Frankly, I would have been more surprised if we didn't cross paths with some new initiative of theirs. Streeter met his look with a small, tight smile.
"Very good, sir."
Something odd hung in her tone. "Very good indeed," he sighed and tapped his teeth again, wondering what was bothering her. "Time to change the subject. How are you doing on those power futures contracts?" Cardoza sees her opening when Otis is relieved from his post just before moonset. One of Bashar's lieutenants, whom she thinks of as Chophead, comes out of the shadows, followed by a kid even younger and more pimply than Otis. Chophead yells at them for a couple of minutes, then slides back into the deep woods, leaving Otis to walk the new kid around. The granite gate stands empty. An unguarded trilithon which could lead to an earlier age of history. She is not so stupid as to rush it in a quiet moment. There are trip lines, monitors, quiet watchers sleeping lightly. No. The opportunity she sees is for social engineering. This new kid doesn't know his shoes from his shirt, that much is obvious. Something's up inside the city, if they're pulling back all the experienced hands. Cardoza thinks he'll be on shoot-to-kill orders for anyone who crosses the perimeter, here, that being the path leading from the stub of the old logging railway trestle, and down through the ravine to the granite gate atop the other side. Even now, Otis walks new kid around, stumbling in the dark, pointing out the perimeter markers, the colored stones that provide ranging points for covering fire, the visible paths and the hidden ones, things he needs to understand and will not remember. Cardoza knows perfectly well there's no point in bracing Otis, but she's pretty sure she can keep new kid from toasting her the minute she comes down the public trail. It takes time and effort to train someone to kill. New kid doesn't have the look. He's a placeholder, filling in here until someone can push him through some live fire exercises and have him kill an aging yuppie or something, just for the practice. Cardoza settles in and chews quietly on a cranberry bar, local produce from the bogs up by the mouth of the Columbia, as if she was a greenie. They aren't completely crazy, after all. Just a bad case of misplaced priorities. She keeps an eye on the granite gate while Otis and New Kid wander, listening to the cadence of their voices as they whisper like bulls blundering through a wheat field. Subtle. These young men were always so subtle. She smiles in the shadows and allows her ears to continue to reconnoiter. Eventually, their voices recede, echoing through the ravine, after which farewells are murmured. Cardoza never catches the rhythm of challenge and response.
New Kid really is a bookmark then, and nothing more. What the hell is going on up there? In her days here, she hasn't seen anything remotely this lax. This was city-grade Mickey Mouse, like she'd expect to see on the Edgewater contract security perimeter at Boeing, Mitsubishi, or Microsoft. She's been given latitude in her mission parameters for a reason. She's just found that reason if she wants to take it. Even so, a walk-up was dangerous. Had to get within earshot to run a talking play. New Kid might get excited, might get lucky, squeeze off a headshot or something. Paid to be smart. This could be a real smart way of getting into Cascadiopolis. Escorted every step of the way. She raises herself back up and zooms in on New Kid with the scope. The starlight is almost pulsing this far from any power grid, but still faint as ever. Even so, the scope is smart enough to deal with that, at least as long as there's some skyshine. New Kid looks nervous to the point of throwing up. He fingers his rifle the way a 14-year-old imagines a woman might want to be touched. Cardoza swallows a silent laugh. His pimples really are worse than poor Otis. Kid, she thinks, after tonight you'll never pull guard duty again. I promise. Taken from an anonymous retrospective on the early to mid-21st century business practices, published under a Creative Commons license. Though corporations as such are by historical nature tied to the sovereign authorities which issued their charters, by the time of the late 19th century, the multinational or transnational model held sway. While wealthy individuals could and did function in the role of corporations under specific circumstances, the combination of distributed risk and accumulated capital was too seductive to resist over time. Even those parts of the world where socio-economic structures varied significantly from the Western European model were not able to combat the allure of corporatism. Imperial China, Communist China, and the Sunni Islamic societies all surrendered. Even Al-Qaeda, that great anti-Western bugaboo of the decades bracketing the turn of the century, owed far more organizationally to the transnational corporations than to any historical Islamic tradition. Then, the Westphalian model of sovereignty, which had prevailed for over 3.5 centuries, abruptly collapsed. Though sovereign states by no means ceased to exist, their absolute control over many aspects of the global economic, diplomatic, and military systems was fractured beyond repair. Corporations were already tenuously tied to their charters and nominal countries of origin through the continual liberalization, which had begun when the United States Supreme Court first opened the door to corporate personhood in the Dartmouth decision of 1819. Now they became de jure sovereign to match their long-time de facto sovereignty, not by positive legal assent, but by sheer default on the part of the chartering bodies. Given the chaos of the times around rising sea levels, worldwide crop failures and energy wars in the Middle East and Africa, few people outside economics faculties even took notice of these changes. It was the ultimate triumph of libertarian free marketism and Straussian neoconservatism. The disasters foretold by 20th century economic liberals came to pass, but again, were no more than a candle in the catastrophic winds blowing across the people and lands of the earth. What no one predicted was that the corporate actors would soon become foundational to the maintenance of continued peace and public order. The first immutable law of capital is that it will be preserved. Hallelujah! Tiger might not have arrived on the wings of the storm, but he certainly brought chaos with him. The dungeons of symmetry are not deep or extensive, but they are as fearful as the workrooms of the Inquisition. That lava tube was the source of all discipline in the undisciplined community of Cascadiopolis. Not that the freemen of the city need fear it. Only outsiders go below, more often than not, without returning to anyone's sight. Except for the birthright Cascadians, children brought to term under the spreading branches of the Douglas firs, everyone here began as an outsider.
Everyone here had been interviewed at the Granite Gate by one or another committee, around the common tables and in whispered intimacy beneath the ever-dripping rhododendrons. A few of us have even descended down the moss-damp steps into Symmetry. We especially know what Tiger faced there. Not racks or arcs of voltage and pain, but the deadly combination of pseudo-cognitive databases and conscious sedation. We gather together, as we so rarely do, to see if this new man will emerge. We sense a world burning in the mucky loam beneath our feet. Still, we do not know what passes within. Tiger ignores the dermal patches. For all they seem to be affecting him, they might as well be dewfall. His smile echoes in its affable silence, an expression strange on his mighty and passionate face. The leather straps holding him to the chair seem almost insubstantial somehow. Bashar has already begun to understand this man's secret. His knowledge is nonverbal, or perhaps preverbal, buried deep in the hindbrain where the triggers of reflex flow. The same instincts that make Bashar a deadly marksman have already surrendered to Tiger. It will be some time before the security chief can unwind his reaction sufficiently to contemplate betrayal. For now, he simply mirrors Tiger's smile and watches two women from the security subcommittee attempt to work the man over. In a way, the sight is funny. Anna Chow is stumpy and angry, with dynamic ink tattoos crawling up and down her arms in a fair representation of the divine wind overwhelming the Mongol fleet. Sometimes, Bashar thinks he can see aircraft carriers sinking in the storm, their stars and stripes flags burning to ash. Anna's primary work detail is supervising the stonemasons who quarry basalt from the ravines and crevices of the mountain beneath their feet, careful to take their slabs and pillars in such a way as to leave a natural-seeming void behind. This has given her the muscles of a stunted giant, but strangely, no patience at all. Her interrogation partner in this game of bad cop, is a little person of African-American descent. Gloria Berry just manages to top 3 feet in height, and she is built like a bowling pin. Gloria is also the single meanest person Bashar has ever known, in a long life filled with evil-minded sadists and good old-fashioned neckbreakers. She is also rumored to have more lovers than any other woman or man in Cascadiopolis. The two of them stacked together would barely be tall enough to stand duty at the Granite Gate, but they'd broken many a testosterone-laced hulk in their time. Tiger just smiles. "I don't freaking care how you got in here," Gloria says with an incongruent echo of menace in her piping voice. "I don't freaking care who you know, who you've done, or who you've bought off to get here." Her fingers fly through a haptic interface of microwatt lasers and passive motion sensors, teasing data out of piezoelectric Malaysian quantum matrices embedded in stone blocks. The tease is not going well. "What I do freaking care about, my sweet, sweet man," Bashar's spine shuddered at that, "is how you've come not to exist anywhere in Western North America." Anna checks Tiger's patches with a worried frown. For all that she swings a hammer on the day shift, her delicacy is a butterfly's. "He's taking it up, Glow. It's just not, well, doing anything." Tiger's smile widens. He clearly has all night to spend here in the delightful company of these women. Bashar's hindbrain stirs, prompting him to speak out of turn. "I don't believe you'll get anywhere with this one, ladies." The look Gloria shoots him would have maimed a lesser man. "We don't tell you your business, soldier boy. Don't you be telling us ours." Anna reaches into a toolbox which was once bright red, but is now covered with layers of stickers in an archaeology of protest and outsider music trends. She brings out an ancient pair of pliers, the handles wrapped in grimy medical gauze. The tool seems to smell like an old wound, even to Bashar lounging 15 feet away. Tiger looks with polite interest, then speaks in a divine voice. You need help fixing something, ma'am.
Only you, says Anna.
Am I in need of some adjustment? If you wish to know something, you have only to ask.
Here, Bashar has to laugh, though he keeps the noise behind his lips. The gruesome twosome have been working Tiger over for an hour, data mining, reading his eye reflexes and the set of his jaw, but they haven't actually tried direct questioning, which admittedly rarely works on people making an involuntary visit to Symmetry, but still represents a deeply amusing problem. Gloria glares at Bashar again, then, with both hands elbow deep in her data, turns the hard-eyed look on Tiger.
Name?
Tiger?
That all of it?
Tiger, actually. There is a benevolent warmth in his tone, spelled the old way.
Right, says Anna in a withering tone.
In a city which is home to people with names like Starbanner, Undine, and Taupe Pantyhose, Bashar finds this hardly fair. Gloria eyes her display suspiciously.
Where were you born?
Nowhere. Anna clacks the pliers, miming the breaking of a knuckle, but Gloria waves her to silence.
How'd you get here?
Walked.
From where?
Further downhill. Admirably truthful answers, Bashar realizes, and profoundly useless. Still, there is something on Gloria's face.
Anna, come here, she says quietly.
Tiger maintains his mask of amity while the other interrogator slips around to the far side of this segment of the lava tube. They don't bother to speak aloud or tell Bashar anything at all. But both heads are quickly focused on the glowing, buzzing universe of information projected above the pile of broken stones.
You ever own an automobile, Tiger?
Gloria asks after a few minutes.
Never. Scooter? Registered bike?
Never.
No bank accounts, says Anna.
That's hardly incriminating, Bashar offers in spite of himself. Half the people here never even touched folding money, let alone held an account.
He is not half the people here, Gloria mutters.
Anna steps over to Tiger with her pair of pliers.
Tell me, ma'am, what happens if I use these?
Tiger's smile widens. You probably would prefer not to find out.
Wrong answer, man.
Her eyes cut to her own enormously muscled bicep. He follows the line of her gaze with the lift of his hand. For a moment they touch, finger to arm, and Bashar realizes how enormous Tiger truly is. Anna is not tall, but her mason's arms are thicker than Bashar's thighs. Tiger's fingers look overlarge, even laid upon her tattoo. The tattoo storm calms beneath his touch, a sunbeam breaking through the clouds, something Bashar has never seen before.
Right answer, woman. He stands, shrugging off the restraining straps as if they'd never been buckled. I believe this interview is over.
It's done when I say it's done, Gloria answers hotly.
Anna is fascinated by her own tattoo and does not reply.
Have you found any data trail on me whatsoever?
No, she admits, her voice is grudging.
Then under which security rule are you holding me?
With Bashar in the interrogation room, Gloria could hardly declare a security emergency, and Bashar himself would be the arbiter of any imminent threats. In this moment, her role is confined to the vetting. With or without prejudice, but the moment for medievalism has already passed. Tiger turns to Bashar.
I would meet your people.
He then gravely nods first to Gloria, then Anna. Will you ladies accompany me?
I'll skinny dip in hell first, Gloria snarls.
Anna smiles and takes the big man's hand. Just by size alone, she could have been his child, giant daughter to a giant father.
They head back out the deeply shadowed hallways of Symmetry, past salvaged cubicle partitions and homemade concrete dividers. Bashar trails behind them. From the deepest part of the lava tube, Gloria's steady, monotonous cursing washes over them like waves up on a distant shore. An excerpt from the Bachigalupi lectures. The concept of soft path technologies is at least as old as Aldo Leopold. 20th century culture had barely noticed the idea, discarding it unused like so many other potential salvations. Much like water, capital seeks the easiest channel. Infrastructure reinvestment requires enormous commitment to long-term planning or the resources of a stable government. Wall Street would never spend the money in any given financial quarter, and it never looked into the future past the next quarter. Cascadiopolis took its inspirations from the same wellsprings as the urban pioneers in Detroit, along with their daughter colonies in Buffalo, Windsor, and elsewhere. The hippies of the 1960s and 1970s, the green movement of the 1990s and 2000s, the apocalyptic undergrounds of the decades of the 21st century. While the individual thinkers and tinkerers who provided the underlying soft paths were scattered throughout history, only in the opening decades of the new millennium was there sufficient social will to implement these on a scale larger than family farming or micro-communities of shared intent. For the first time since the invention of coinage, social capital was able to trump financial capital. Social capital itself is perhaps the greatest of those soft path technologies. The root causes of such change are as fantastically varied as the root causes of any cultural movement, but the proximate causes are stunningly clear. The failure of governmental institutions outside of the defense sector was a deliberate strategy of late 20th century Republican leadership. By the early 21st century, conservatives had succeeded beyond their wildest imaginings, only to meet with disaster. Instead of a libertarian paradise of unrestrained capital lifting a rising tide of employers, workers, and households, an economic apocalypse emerged which made the Great Depression look like a post-Christmas sales slump. At the same time, 200 years of aggressive industrialism, combined with a deliberately self-censored policy of abusive neglect of climate change trends, came home to roost in an overwhelming way. The loss of New Orleans was not a fluke. It was a harbinger. Mobile, then Charleston, then Miami followed within years. The upper speed of hurricane winds increased by 40% during that period, forcing a revision to the Beaufort scale. Sea levels rose as currents shifted to bring polar meltwater south. The financial disasters on Wall Street and Main Street were echoed for anyone who lived too close to water. Suddenly, solar-powered hot water heaters and window-box greenhouses didn't seem so silly. Even to dyed-in-the-wool conservatives, convinced that the 6-meter waves pounding the Gulf Coast were somehow a political conspiracy concocted by the left. Even then, as always, most people were incrementalists. The balance of power shifted, in that the activist minority grew from a noisy fringe to a major movement within American society. In this, they were welcomed by their green brethren in Europe and the Third World. And so Cascadiopolis was built, one soft path at a time.
We don't know what to make of him, we who stand like owls ranked in the darkness. Mother Moon has said early, so the shadows under the trees are nearly as dark as the shadows beneath the stones. Still, we wait out the time of blood and screams and query hacks, watching the tunnel's entrance as if our own deaths lurk within. When Tiger emerges, he stands tall with fists cocked upon his hip and sweeps his gaze across us. More than half of the city's shifts are present by then. Over 2,000 souls crowded shoulder to shoulder on branches and along paths. We breathe as one beast, mutter as one many-headed animal, shift our collective weight and stare. The man himself is almost luminous.
His skin shines out of the shadows, and his eyes flash as if target-painted by distant lasers. He looks back and forth, taking us in, then tilts his head, takes a great breath, and speaks but one word. "Hope," Tiger says in a voice which ripples through us all. At that we dissolve into 2,000 tired, grumpy people looking for sleep, sex, food, explanations. Whatever has bound us together dissolves like cardboard in the rain, and we dribble away from the majesty of his presence like cats pretending they'd never seen a dog in the street outside that screen door. Still, we are almost all gone, save a few stragglers. Flanked by Bashar and Anna Chow, the large man looks over the city as if it were his own. Eventually he speaks again. "They're coming for you, you know."